Fucking kill him! Kill him! Get him! Like, I was trying to choke Ray Liotta to death in my theater seat. And I was, like, trying to help Jeff Daniels choke him out. Like, I had completely lost touch with the idea that this was a movie and that there was going to be a predetermined end. I genuinely thought that if I contracted my muscles hard enough that we could get him to black out together, me.
She has the meal. She doesn't even get her pie. She sobs over her pie.
I think I was digging my hands into your leg.
We've never seen Ray Liotta this jacked before.
Hey guys, welcome back. All right.
Woo! Hey guys.
Welcome back to another episode of The Crowded Theater. I am Kyle.
I am Taylor.
And I am Cliff.
Yes, welcome back guys. Welcome to The Crowded Theater, the only podcast where all the movies are seen in theaters, only in theaters, exclusively. We didn't actually research that if we're the only one. I mean, there might be four or five out there, but we don't know. How are you guys doing?
So far, so good. Happy Sunday.
Oh, yeah. Great weather out there this Sunday.
Yes. No, it is a good weather, but we are indoors, just like a crowded theater itself. We've seen some interesting screenings this weekend that we're here to talk about.
Some old school screenings.
We saw two movies at the Austin Film Society Theater. The movies we're here to talk about, two comedies, two romantic-ish comedies.
Could be argued.
two kind of quirky sort of inversions of the idea of a romantic comedy that were both playing. I think good programming choice to have them both playing at AFS around that time. 1972's The Heartbreak Kid, directed by Elaine May, starring Charles Grodin, Sybil Shepherd. And we saw 1986's Something Wild, directed by Jonathan Demme, starring Jeff Daniels and Melanie Griffith, and Ray Liotta. And Ray Liotta's first film, apparently.
Yes,
which is very, very cool. We'll get into that here in a moment.
What a good first screening for him.
Yes, and it was an interesting screening experience this week in that we've seen a lot of really unambiguously fun and cool movies that we really dug. Taylor had a different experience, certainly with Heartbreak Kid. Taylor, what was your experience of The Heartbreak Kid? I'm very curious.
It is sold and marketed as a comedy, and one can be argued that it is funny.
I think the audience was laughing quite a bit.
Oh yes, and there were jokes, but without going super into it and spoiling it, there are it is a morally gray character, for lack of a better phrasing, and I don't know if the audience is necessarily supposed to be on his side.
But Taylor wasn't.
But I wasn't, and we'll get into why later.
No. I mean, so to kind of sum it up, The Heartbreak Kid is, I guess, the plot is it's for Neil Simon adapting like a Gentleman's Magazine story, which is from Esquire magazine, which is exactly what it sounds like. What it kind of feels like, because it is about a young newlywed man, like you might see in a National Lampoon story or something like that, married to a young woman, realizing immediately after marrying, played by Charles Grodin, realizing immediately after they are married that he can't stand her because
there's a bunch of surprise annoyances.
He married her to have sex with her, and then they sleep together, and then after he has finally consummated their relationship, he sees things with sudden clarity and notices all these, you know, little quirks about her, and so on his honeymoon ends up falling for a crazy college-age girl played by Sybil Shepherd, who had lots of experience as a home wrecker that she could bring to that character, which we can get into. But and so he ends up stalking and trying to pick up another woman on his honeymoon, and I think That just was a bridge too far for Taylor. A bridge too far for Taylor. And I do get it. I will say this. It was definitely a movie that it definitely got the audience laughing.
I can definitely
huge
say
huge laughs.
The theatrical experience is, yes, despite the comedy or not comedy perspective, the audience was uproariously laughing the whole time, and yet you can say that as comedy scenes, they were executed like gangbusters beginning to end. But I think it's the and also started as a stage play. It was a Neil Simon play, so maybe even the distance of looking at it as like skits taking place on a stage might distance you a little bit from the drama.
It definitely feels like a stage play. I was trying to see. I think Neil Simon wrote it, but was it based on a stage play? I think it was him adapting a short story.
I assumed it was a stage play.
As did I.
Neil Simon, but maybe not.
And to a degree, that's the thing, is it really does feel like many other films that are adapted from stage plays, in which largely they have long dialogue scenes that are then separated by vast quantities of time, where big, overt, silly ideas like them going from Florida tropical beach island getaway to frigid Minnesota, mm-hmm. you can imagine playing very well on stage, where suddenly everyone's in big parkas and it whisks you away to another area. But it's the kind of movie where I think one cannot help, and perhaps one, you know, perhaps trained on conventional romantic comedies and that sort of thing, can't help but invest somewhat in the idea of their marriage in the first part of the film. And then as it begins to, as his newlywed wife sort of begins to exit the movie, we sort of kind of enter a very kind of diffuse second half where he pursues Sybil Shepherd and it kind of eventually winds to a halt. And what kind of good time were you having during this movie, Taylor?
You know, it's funny because you whether intentional or not, you find the actual wife very endearing. So she's quirky, she's got these, you know, she gets a really bad sunburn on her wedding, so she has to be stuck in her hotel room, and she's a little loud and a little annoying, but you just find her very endearing. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of also are, at least I would assume, as an audience, you're kind of wanting them to kind of reconcile. You're kind of wanting the comeuppance of, like, something mm-hmm. to blow up in his face and not, and he has to go back to his wife. Mm-hmm. No, he leaves the wife on the honeymoon, spoiler alert. Mm-hmm. But then you have the kind of an interesting scene of when he goes and visits the Sybil Shepherd character at her college, and you kind of have the scene of where, like, oh yay, like, she kind of pretends like she doesn't know him, or she kind of, like, tries to blow him off, and then she just changes her mind because she's so mm-hmm. fun and free and sexy and kind of, like, goes with him. And then it has, like, a bunch of fun scenes with her dad, and kind of mm-hmm. has, you know, like, very early Meet the Fockers kind of vibes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, I think this is also where my experience was, I really, really found it really, really funny, was laughing great. I'd never seen this movie before, was laughing like crazy in the first half. But as I think even the little blurb they put up about this said, as a forefather of cringe comedy, and I'm in general not a fan of cringe comedy, and you know, that is to say, I've never seen but more than an episode of the Ricky Gervais Office, all that stuff just sort of, you know, not really necessarily for me. But it was interesting because this, I really enjoyed the first half of the movie. And then as it began to sort of meander into the Minnesota half and into the end of the thing, exactly the point where now the sort of weird, I don't know, just like mosaic of sketches they had thrown together, mm-hmm. you want them to sort of crystallize dramatically into something energetically that kind of lifts you up and takes you out of that, and instead it sort of putters and loses energy as it gets to the end. But that being said, a lot of it works really fucking well prior to that, and I really dug that. Cliff, what were some of the things that worked about Heartbreak Kid? Were some of the funny things?
Well, one thing I were noting when looking at the trailer for the remake of the Heartbreak mm-hmm. Kid that the Farrelly brothers did not see the remake.
That's
but you
good
can tell
point.
A lot
yes,
by
yes,
looking
yes,
at the trailer
yes.
is one thing that's great about the original Heartbreak Kid is that so much of what's going on is subtextual and is played out by just the camera lingering on mm-hmm. Charles Grodin's face as he reacts to things.
Yeah,
we
yeah.
see, you know, we're just on his face reacting to how annoyed he is at his wife.
Her singing voice in the car
yeah.
and her eating egg salad sandwiches.
Yeah, he never ever externalizes that in any way. He doesn't say any words in the text mm-hmm. that indicate that he's annoyed. It's just all played out mm-hmm. on his face. And then watching, just having fun watching the trailer for the remake. Mm-hmm. And in the remake, he has, of course, like in most modern romantic comedies, he has a best friend who he's calling on the phone all the
yes.
time and talking to.
The perennial best friend, Rob Corddry, the bald perennial best
yeah.
friend of many romantic comedies.
Exactly. And the role of that best friend in romantic comedies yeah. is just basically as a plot device so that the guy can externalize yeah. his internal thoughts to someone.
Yeah.
And whereas in the remake of Heartbreak Kid was very conventional of, you know, every doubt about his wife and wanting to leave his wife was externalized by calling his best friend and saying it aloud in words. But
mm-hmm.
here, all of that was just mm-hmm. done cinematically and with performance.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
it was, yeah, exceptionally well made from that regard, exceptional performance
yeah, yeah.
from Charles Grodin in that regard.
Yeah, no, and I think that's,
yeah.
so it's worth giving some context that, yeah, so the Farrelly brothers remade this movie in what looked like probably, Farrelly Brothers director of There's Something About Mary did a remake of The Heartbreak Kid with Ben Stiller
mm-hmm.
that hopefully I think was trying to recapture some of that There's Something About Mary magic. And they made some smart choices. I've never seen the remake, so I can't comment on it. But they made some, you know, strong and I would say smart choices in terms of, and this I bring this up in furtherance of in how they cast the movie just based upon the trailer that kind of reconcile some of the issues of misplaced empathy and other things that in the first film that make the first film a very, very black comedy and make this the second make the remake presumably a more accessible comedy. That is to say, in the film, it is hard to empathize with Charles Grodin in any way because his wife, who is played by Elaine May's daughter, as it turns out, I totally thought it was Elaine May when the movie started because I remember, and I know what she looks like from seeing her much older in movies like Small Time Crooks, and I was like, oh, I didn't realize she played that, and it doesn't. It was her daughter, actually, who was like 23 years old at the time, who had Jeannie Berlin, who has been in a lot of stuff since then. She was in Inherent Vice. Anyway, she feels like the girl next door. She feels kind of goofy and endearing. We cannot help but kind of despise him and hope energetically the movie bends back towards some sort of comeuppance for her in some way. Whereas especially when the object of his desire is sort of clearly,
blonde hair, blue eyes, 18-year-old, big old tits.
Like nothing interesting about her personality whatsoever. And again, in that way, what it makes it, as rather than being an accessible romantic comedy, it makes it, a character study of a despicable guy. And as a character study of a despicable guy, and watching him make all of these insane choices, and being aghast at all the choices he makes, it definitely works on that level, but it definitely was, I could feel it actively repelling Taylor the whole time I was watching the movie.
She was like, fuck this guy, fuck this movie,
fuck all of this. And it was very interesting, as opposed to, and it made me think, and that's why we watched the trailer afterwards, that instead, by casting the Sybil Shepherd looking girl, the Farrelly brothers cast Molly Ackerman, who is a supermodel looking blonde. It puts the sort of moral, the idea of him rushing into a marriage with this girl, it makes that lustful and morally dubious. So therefore, when the marriage is, it allows us to fully indulge in laughing at her sunburn, presumably, or all the things that he was blind to because he was too horny to see when he was getting with her, when he was courting her, that now he, on their honeymoon, realizes it totally it makes us kind of understand that energetically. And then they cast the more obviously still movie star gorgeous Michelle Moynihan to play the girl next door vibes, who I'm sure, despite the fact that I have not seen the Farrelly Brothers remake, I'm sure is wholesome and has lots of redeeming qualities. And that makes sense.
She drank beer and had, all those boyish qualities.
There you go. See, you would really like There's Something About Mary. You haven't seen it, but you understand. There you go.
And by the way, I'll also say that... in the end, just to give spoilers for the ending here, for the very ending, in the end, he ends up married to Sybil Shepherd character and very unhappy. We see him at the end not talking to her, and he hears the song from his old wedding, and he's, concerned with his money prospects in Minnesota and not liking the options of working for a veal factory or whatever else, like the plastics business in The Graduate.
Yeah.
And then it ends kind of like The Graduate with him staring off ambiguously.
Yeah, some sort of weird ambiguous
girl.
And then,
And I'll say that it would, if it were more detached, basically, if it were a stage play or more like a skit, if we were less kind of, and also, obviously, if we were less, if the original wife is less endearing, it could have worked. I could have worked if there was some more distance from it. But just with the intimacy of cinema and just we get to really see people interact with good actors, giving performances and having chemistry with each other, it's like, okay, I can see Charles Grodin really working out with this original gal.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like they obviously should be back together. Obviously the siren that is Sybil Shepherd is something that must be rejected. Yada, yada, yada.
And that's the thing is that what works as a kind of Playboy men's magazine story, I think it was from Esquire, and I'm sure would also work if it were cut up into a bunch of individual sketches, much like the ones that Elaine May did herself with Mike Nichols, where she played, dumb and played whatever. I feel like it works on a beat-to-beat level. I think the reason we're all stopping and starting, and I can feel it so much, and talking about this movie that clearly was really hilarious, but talking about it as if it's some sort of failed experiment, is because I felt this a little bit. I mean, I know that you had a different experience than a lot of the audience did in the movie, but I do think legitimately it's one of those things that the film is so objectively funny in the first half. We're having such a good time that when it does that, and then after we laugh our asses off for the first half of this movie, there is something that feels suddenly very diffuse and vague and unsatisfying about the back half of the movie, such that when we're exiting the theater, by contrast to Something Wild, which we'll get to in a minute, when we're exiting the theater, instead of thinking, oh boy, what a great movie The Heartbreak Kid is, I found myself puzzling over why I felt kind of hollow and then trying to think back on the fond memories of the early parts of the movie that I enjoyed so much.
Well, here's this. I mean, the back half is integrated by something, plot-wise. Yeah. It's integrated by his pursuit of and then finally getting Sybil Shepherd. But the problem is, if we were in any way invested in the success of his quest, as opposed to seeing his quest as utterly foolish and hoping that he will soon figure out that he should go back, and maybe, who knows, maybe in the after the end of the movie, that's what he does.
Yeah.
You can only hope. That's certainly where his mind is drifting at the end of the movie. It kind of sort of implies that. But because we're not invested in the success of that quest, that's where the energy kind of dissipates. If we're really invested in making that work out, then we're invested in him fighting past the resistance of the father and all that. But no, we're kind of on board with the father here. Get the fuck out of here, asshole.
Yeah, I know. It's like totally on board with the father.
Take the cold
scenes.
Hard cash. Get the hell out.
Just shoot that guy.
$25,000 at one point.
When he shows up and he's marrying Charles Grodin, my first thought is, I think a much more satisfying place for this film to have gone would be if the father had just then, we cut to him, he's our new protagonist, he starts sawing off a shotgun, and it's about him killing and burying Charles Grodin's body. I would watch that movie.
That's great.
You know, there was just something about it where it's like, as we kind of got into the back half of the thing, where it just sort of felt like, I guess this is the thing, is that the kind of comedy that we're seeing, this wedding and even this couple having a goofy but obviously a trouble-filled honeymoon, puts us in a particular mindset. And I'll get to what that mindset, a romantic comedy mindset, something. Rock Hudson, Doris Day, I don't know what. It puts us in a mindset. And then the structure of the movie, though, is very satirical theater. It is very, if you remember, like fucking Neil LaBute plays, or his, when he transitioned into making movies, he did like In the Company of Men, or
Friends and Neighbors.
Yeah, Your Friends and Neighbors, exactly. With these black satirical scenes just cutting to different people at places in their lives, seeing long dialogue, very theater-like, seeing long dialogue scenes play out, and then advancing as we see them tear each other apart, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, I can be on board with the type of, with a movie like that. And I can understand also, in 1972, merely the act of seeing a guy rushing into a marriage and immediately sort of being repelled from his wife probably put people in a kind of transgressive mindset where perhaps they were prepared for where the movie was going, because that felt naughty. Whereas nowadays, in some ways, because that is so much the fodder of every episode of, you know, Modern Family or every other kind of show that already exists, the idea of a husband and wife bickering and being annoyed at each other, etc. It feels like we're emotionally being primed for something that will have a resonant heart that comes back around in a cathartic way, and instead then we're just treated to sort of the kind of sterile distance of, and now we're in Minnesota, and a series of dialogue scenes jumping over large periods of time, and then eventually to, again, an ending that strongly parallels the ending of The Graduate, which was directed by Mike Nichols, Elaine May's former comedy partner, so one could understand why she would be trying to get a little bit of that Graduate energy in there, get some of that juice that works so well for Mike Nichols. Except it doesn't feel, it feels, it, there is, the thing is clawing after some kind of meaning, but beyond him, it's just a character study of a very kind of morally dubious guy. I do like all of his "there's no deceit in this corn" bit he does with the father. Beyond a character study, it doesn't feel like there's enough meaning there for that to have any meaning. And so it's a film that feels energetically very packed at the beginning, and the audience was very hot, and then that energy just became diffuse and it petered out and everyone left in relative silence after the movie was over. And that was a unique experience, because I was just thinking back on how much we were laughing in the beginning and all of that. But I don't know, what am I missing about Cybill Shepherd? That's what we should talk about next. What were your feelings about Cybill Shepherd, Taylor?
I liked her performance. I thought her performance was really great. I think that she as an actress was really good. Mm. I also kind of can respect a little bit of the, like, 18-year-old nymph energy, because, like, she really did pursue, to as much as I disliked the main male actor, she definitely pursued him, and she definitely kind of made him not be able to say no, in a way, like, you know.
Oh, yeah, no, that's one of those things where, as we were kind of talking about a little bit on the way out of the movie, it is funny to see Cybill Shepherd come in playing the homewrecker, because she would have, at that point, been, I guess, probably tabloid famous for being a homewrecker who was cast by Peter Bogdanovich in Last Picture Show, which was her big break and made her not a model but a movie star. And then she ended up breaking up the marriage of Peter Bogdanovich and Polly Platt, his wife, and they ended up they were sort of a tabloid couple, this director and, you know, 18-year-old girl, yada yada. So she had lots of experience as a homewrecker, which she could bring to bear.
What's the phrasing? She was a character actor.
That's right. She was a method actor. Method actress. She knew what she was doing. Yeah, and that's sort of the thing, is that especially once the first wife's character sort of leaves the movie at a certain point, you kind of want her...
Let's just give her a little bit more credit. She gets divorced. She sobs over the meal that she's been excited for this whole meal, for this whole trip for. She finally gets to go to the meal. She has the meal. She doesn't even get her pie. She sobs over her pie. And then she's just gone. She never comes back. Uh-huh. There's never any... Like, as we've been saying, like, there's no kind of come up, and she doesn't get to, like... hurrah, like, he's just gone after that.
Yeah, and that's sort of the thing, is that the movie feels like it cultivates energies that ultimately go nowhere, and so it feels like kind of a frustrating, constipated experience of a movie. And I guess for their particular type of person, that is a fun movie going experience, and I can't tell you what it would have been like in 1972, but it was, and I'm glad I saw it in a movie theater for sure, because I was able to laugh along with everyone. But I don't know if it's for me. Sorry,
I was just remembering the scene where she was kind of finally standing up for herself. She was like, "Are you having fun? Like, this is is this a good honeymoon to you?" And I'm like, "No, he's probably having the great time." Like, and it really does kind of, again, it's supposed to be fun. And it is a funny scene, but it also has the audience, you're like, yeah, she's having an awful time on her honeymoon, dude.
Yeah. It's funny, because the thing of someone who comes from that same world is Woody Allen, who has made many very similar films about morally dubious men who are being unfaithful to their wives. And I think Woody Allen even talks about in his book the fact that he learned a lot of his craft from Neil Simon's brother, who was a writer, and I think he worked with him in television or something. So close relationships between those two things. And yet Woody Allen's movies would start in a place like this, but always, not always, but I think part of what was great about him is they had great third acts often. There was a desire to not just...
An emotionally satisfying third act.
Yes, exactly. He would have, like, emotionally satisfying third act, even in his early, perhaps not in the early sillier films, but in all of the later films, he would cultivate the energies in Manhattan or in Annie Hall or in any of these movies and actually pay them off when Woody Allen's running all the way back to morally dubious 17-year-old Muriel Hemingway in Manhattan. But at least it's paying off the energy the movie has cultivated up to that point. And so you leave Manhattan feeling like you were at the peak of the energy in that movie.
And also, just to make a comparison, in that one, even though, well, there's a hell of a lot that's dubious about the choices that he makes, but at least, you know, performance-wise and emotionally, we are on board with him there, because we, you know, don't like the Diane Keaton character in that as much as we do the you know, her similar role in Annie Hall. We don't see them getting together at the end and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, it is interesting because, yeah, in Manhattan, and just to bring it in, I think we went and watched it probably. Yeah, but we want, where, you know, yeah, again, Woody Allen is falling for a, you know, Diane Keaton, who is a very kind of selfish and narcissistic, you know, self-obsessed but fancy intellectual woman. But in that movie, and again, it's hard to compare any old movie to one of the better movies made in of that decade, but in that movie, part of the reason we're okay with that is we understand, we feel like the movie, we trust that the movie knows that Diane Keaton is morally dubious and is doing something with that, and that is actually going to pay off over the course of the movie, as opposed to just simmering at that level.
For example, if the if in Heartbreak Kid, that the OG wife wasn't just merely doing some things that were a little annoying or a little dumb, but was, you know, displaying cruelty to strangers or being, you know, pretentious or doing anything that would put him off in a way that we don't actually like her. But all the ways in which she annoys him are just kind of, she's a little annoying and a little dumb. Isn't that endearing? Everyone's a little annoying and a little dumb in little ways, and you'll get used to it in a second. But, that's sort of the vibe that you get at the beginning.
In a weird, in that way, it almost thins the movie out and feels like it removes subtext from the movie, because then the lady who is annoying is nothing but annoying, and the girl who is attractive is nothing but attractive, and the guy who is, you know, ambitious and vapid and, you know, whatever, has no greater depth to be revealed. And so in a weird way, as much as these, I don't know, as much as people look at out of the more traditional romantic comedy structure as being somewhat contrived, or the moral lessons imparted by films that see dubious characters punished and then learn a lesson and come back, like Bill Murray does in most of his movies. Starts out as a morally dubious guy, and then he repeats the same day every, you know, over and over again until he can really appreciate Andie MacDowell for who she is. You know, again, that's, you know, the sort of arc of the thing. Is that it makes you kind of aware that you trust the hands that you are in, you know, the kind of that the, you know, what is intentional and what isn't in the movie, but it also, it adds a dynamism to the thing, because you get to see a scumbag character have to wrestle with morality, and then he has a place to go, and so the film evolves and changes. Whereas when you sort of refuse that in that sort of Seinfeldian, no hugging, no crying sort of a way, which works, I think, maybe for a 22-minute sitcom, but not for a movie, when you have that sort of ironic New York distance, et cetera, et cetera, as fun as that is intellectually as a game, a satirical game, it is very thin and very flat. It lacks the subtext and dynamism of even a conventional melodramatic romance, you know, of just like, he's a rugged hero guy, but he's a blue-collar guy, and she's works in an office, and they don't like each other, but then they fall in love. Like, that has actual dynamism to it in a way that perhaps is not as chin-scratchingly curious as a New York satirical deconstruction of a whatever the fuck, but what you ultimately get is something that just is what it is on the surface. It's like, ooh, the wife is, she seems annoying now with egg salad on her face, but then there's no but. You know, it's like, oh, Charles Grodin, he seems superficial and vain, but, and going after the Sybil Shepherd girl now, until it is revealed that, but then we don't get that. You know, the Sybil Shepherd girl seems like nothing but vapid and bad and whatever until, and then we don't even really understand why she changes her mind about him in the first place. And so it just, everything is what it is. It's like, it feels more like a comic strip. I mean, Iron Man feels more true to life as a movie, and this feels more like a comic strip, to be honest. But go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, I was literally trying to think of, like, what is Sybil Shepherd's, like, character in that movie? Like, what is her person? And literally, she goes almost, like, in a 180 in a specific scene I remembered. She goes the whole front half of the movie, she's actively kind of pursuing, kind of flouncing around this one guy, assumedly to annoy Daddy, and assumedly to make her dad annoyed. And then, you know, he comes and chases her out. And you think that this is going to, again, like I referenced earlier, this is going to be the moment he finds her at her Minnesota college. She's literally arm in arm with another pretty blonde man. Mm-hmm. And you think that she's going to be like, what do you mean, loser? I don't know who you are. And then, like, that's going to be the comeuppance. But no, he, like, gets her into a car. He, like, talks to her after a second time after, like, coming after her again. Gets her into her car. And almost as if he reminds her. Mm-hmm. He's like, hey, by the way, what was the... That's my spot. That's my stool. And she's like, all right. And then she, like, dates him. And it, like, it doesn't really have
Again, it seems
structure.
Like she makes a sudden decision to kiss him and date him so that more of the movie can happen.
Yeah.
And more cringe can scenes can happen in front of the father. And the film doesn't really do anything. Nothing is revealed or earned in order to that
alternatively,
happen.
Let's say that he shown up and then gotten, like, simultaneously gets his ass kicked by the father and the football boyfriend, and she rejects him, and then beaten up and with his tail between his legs, he's trying to chase back his OG wife because he remembers that it really, really did have a good thing together.
Yeah.
And then that's where the rest of the comedy resumes, when he has just divorced one woman, run off with another, and now is trying to get her back. That could be a third act.
That is a segue, a fantastic segue into, and I think we'll probably circle back because there's a lot of similarities between these two films. But it's a great segue into the second film we saw, because part of the reason I think we're beating up so hard on The Heartbreak Kid is we saw another film that had similarly began cultivating the energy of a man, a straight-laced, normal, boring, conservative man running away from his normal, boring, conservative life, his wife and kids presumably, in morally dubious fashion, to go and pursue an obviously morally dubious girl, Sybil Shepherd in the first film, and Melanie, the most morally dubious person, Melanie Griffith, in the second film.
She oozes moral dubiousness from her pores, at least in this era. She's coming right out of Body Double.
Right out of Body Double, exactly. Which is apparently who Jonathan Demme cast her after seeing her in Body Double, which if Body Double plays anytime in a theater, which it does occasionally, we will review it on this podcast.
She's a good actress.
Yeah, no, she's great. More on Melanie Griffith in just 1 second. So Something Wild... Something Wild is Jonathan Demme, 1986. We were actually talking about how in a lot of ways it's similar to Blue Velvet in that...
Blue Velvet.
You're wearing a Blue Velvet shirt. Kick ass. Awesome.
See both cameras. Yeah, 1986 and very similar movies, oddly. Yeah. Very different styles.
Very different styles, very different directors. Yes,
but similar premise.
But very similar premises, and also at the same time, you have the fact that famously David Lynch was coming off of Dune, in 1984, big budget thing, kind of flopped, ends up getting back to his roots and making what would essentially his rebirth as a filmmaker in Blue Velvet that would then allow him to go. And again, part of the reason, we'll get to why we're comparing it to Blue Velvet in a minute. And then Jonathan Demme was coming off of what he describes as the debacle of a movie called Swing Shift, which was the movie where Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell met. It was a big World War II movie that was taken away from him and re-edited, and that he said was a real painful experience. And so he goes back to Meat and Potatoes a couple years later in 1986 and makes this film. Were you going to say something about Blue Velvet?
Nothing beyond. The parallel track of both directors led to, oddly enough, them both simultaneously making very similar movies, similar premise, which is...
Yeah, just the idea that, and again, I say this because this was our first time watching Something Wild, which is crazy. We've seen a lot of Jonathan Demme's work, love Silence of the Lambs. I had even bought tickets to see Something Wild years ago at the New Beverly in LA, but then ended up having to cancel that trip. So it was waiting for this particular screening, this particular moment.
In 35 millimeter
at the AFS. And we had a fantastic and much better experience, I think that's where I was going before, with Something Wild, which cultivates that same quirky, comedic, satirical energy of a very different era in the first half of the film. And by contrast to The Heartbreak Kid, it seems to know exactly what it wants to do with that energy. It seems to be way smarter than the audience. In fact, I honestly, as a very astute film viewer who went in kind of cold about where the film was going, it really surprised me as to where it was going. The film was smarter than me in terms of where it was set, what it was setting up. And it uses that first half, which does feel morally dubious and disjointed, but the film you can trust something wild. It knows exactly what it's doing, and it uses that to anticipate a second half where the quirky romance about a manic pixie dream girl dragging Jeff Daniels from his humdrum life and wife and kids suddenly becomes a full-on crime movie, a genre movie, where, not unlike in Blue Velvet, where the great Dennis Hopper shows up as a very mean, very scary, very ominous gangster villain who suddenly tests Kyle MacLachlan and he, you know, puts him through the ringer. Ray Liotta, in his first film role, shows up as, appropriately enough, Ray in the film, the ex-convict husband of Melanie Griffith, who then, you know, takes... takes Jeff Daniels to hell and back for being with his wife and all of that, which was a genuine surprise. And it is a gem of a movie in how smartly and how well and just how cleverly it plays the first half of the movie in a way that brilliantly sets up where it's going, while at the same time utterly misdirecting the audience as to where it is going. And the reason I say that, and just to give the short version before kind of just ending this long monologue, it's one of those movies where if it were in the hand, the same script were in the hands of a different director, and the script did come to Jonathan Demme from another writer, they would make it their job to anticipate the crime film in the first half of the film. So Melanie Griffith would look like some, you know, convict's ex-wife. You would see her ulterior motives painted all over her. They would want to even everything out so there wasn't a jarring shift. And exactly what we were talking about with From Dusk Till Dawn just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, good comparison.
Very similar thing. But instead, the film fully embraces, because Jonathan Demme is very much of this quirky New York bohemian indie music scene, it fully embraces the idea that we are just in some sort of whimsical indie film about a man being, like, as if it's some sort of French New Wave movie, about a almost paper cutout of a businessman being whisked away by a girl who is so eccentric it sort of defies any explanation. She's like dressed in like weird like African bracelets and necklaces and shit, and like just chugging scotch whiskey as she's driving down the road, and it's so arch.
Abandons her car immediately, decides not worth it.
It feels so arch that, you know, you're like, I hope this is going somewhere. Because it's almost not unlike with a little bit with Heartbreak Kid. It's kind of hard to hold on to the reality of the movie in those scenes. Because you're like, is this just supposed to be fucking weird for the sake of weird? Or is this going somewhere? Like, am I wasting my time trying to ask questions about what's going on here? And as it turns out, in the best way possible, every question, why is she... every misdirection, everything is teeing up the audience for this fantastic transition at the midpoint in the movie into a completely different type of story. But anyway, I'm very curious. Part of that transition, when it leaves whimsical romance and enters crime movie, before we get deeper into the plot of the movie, is the exoneration of Jeff Daniels' character, who up to this point, we as an audience, and more critically, Melanie Griffith as a character, believes that he is also a morally dubious character. We're saying the phrase morally dubious is coming up a lot in this podcast, because he is cheating on his wife and he has abandoned his kids to go off with her on this whole thing. And then we find out at the midpoint in the movie, among other revelations, that his wife has already left him and he is in fact... and I could feel... And to talk about... This is a great example of what we were... to sort of contrast it against The Heartbreak Kid. This is a film that is aware that there's only so much we're going to put up with this guy cheating on his wife. This is a film that says, okay, well, that's going to start building an energy. So what's that energy going to do? What are we going to do with that energy? The energy is either going to be him getting some sort of comeuppance or something, but instead it rewrites the story at the midpoint, but it does it really brilliantly in a way where it takes that rewrite seriously. It takes that revelation seriously in a way that it makes him evidently a good guy up to that point, so that when we, through his actions, through his behavior, through the choices he makes, through, and even we'll get to in a second, through Jonathan Demme talks about making him talk to, and like even how he knows the waitress's name from her name tag and all that. He's a decent guy. So when we find out, it doesn't make sense in our head that he just ran out. It just doesn't seem to fit. And then that disjunction is intentional, and we realize suddenly that he's not cheating on his wife, that he is in fact, that she left him, and that he is a lost guy. And we even begin that suddenly, why is he stealing his lunch in the opening scene, which is what makes Melanie Griffith zero in on him as another dubious character who she doesn't feel bad about basically using from that point on, because she sees him steal his lunch, is that he's lost. He doesn't have a wife, doesn't have kids. And again, he feels like a paper cut out of a person in that first scene. And by the end
of... He wears
like
a gray suit for the first half, too.
Exactly, you know, like, wearing literally. A gray suit. Yeah, his costume plot is a whole other thing to talk about here in a minute. But by the time we make it back to his house at the end of the movie, the reality of his suburban home emptied out with his single chair in front of the TV and the TV tray with all the stacked up cups on it, it's like, it fully takes seriously this idea of who he is as a divorced person all the way through to the end, so that when you see the end of the movie and you see him in his house with the cups and everything before he, you know, all of what happens in the end, which we'll get to, you realize that that's the guy who was stealing his lunch at the beginning. That's the desperate man and all of that. And so every bit of the energy in the front half, which is, again, this fever dream, this where a guy is literally pulled away by a drinking crazy girl to go on a whimsical road trip adventure, and she chains him to a motel room bed and has sex with him and
calls his boss
and tells him he won't be in for a couple days and all this other shit, is going somewhere. So I'm curious, given all that, Taylor, I could tell that your investment in the movie increased dramatically after you found out. I think that has something to do with the fact that we watched The Heartbreak Kid right before.
For sure.
It teed us up like, oh, fuck, another one? You know?
No, we literally had joked even before we got into the movies, like, maybe we should watch the trailer of the second movie just to see what kind of movie we were walking into, because we learned the hard way through Heartbreak Kid. I don't like divorce stories. and honestly, you can honestly feel, at least in myself, I could feel like the sigh of relief of like, oh, and you do kind of find it in a very fun character, like fun way. Like, so what is the blonde woman's name? What is the female main character?
Her name is Audrey in the movie, but he calls her Lulu.
You find out that Audrey kind of like pulls him into her old high school reunion, which coincidentally one of her other female classmates was married to one of his businessmen co-workers thing. And it is through him that it is revealed that, oh no, his wife and kids left him, because of course your co-workers kind of know your business, at least on that level. And so you kind of do have this big sigh of relief of like, oh, thank God I'm not having to like be on the side of this guy again.
And the other thing, what it does, I think what the movie begins to reveal is that Melanie Griffith's character of Audrey is not just some motivationless manic pixie dream girl, but that she has observed him, picked him out, and is now pulling him away for a specific purpose, which is that she has her 10-year high school reunion, which, funny enough, is she was the class of 1976. So just all the great new Hollywood movies make reference to the bicentennial, this film directly channels that sort of new Hollywood energy by means of having a 1976 class reunion where, because it's 1976, the bicentennial, everyone's dressed in little Uncle Sam hats, and there's all this American flag stuff everywhere, and that she comes from a conservative Pennsylvania town that's having a 10-year reunion, she has a conservative mom, and that she just wants, and that she sees Jeff Daniels as exactly the kind of guy who she would like everyone in her town to think she ended up with. And that poses a question: why does she need someone to stand in as her husband, and why does she pick Jeff Daniels and all this? And again, that is a question that, again, is anticipating the second half of the movie in a way that wouldn't have to necessarily pay off if it had continued to just be a whimsical whatever the fuck. But instead, you're starting to realize, okay, there's an intention here in her character, in the film. What's happening? She's taking him to the high school reunion. She's not giving him any heads up. She's taking him home to meet the mother, saying that Jeff Daniels is her husband. He's playing along. He's going with it. We're still in this place where we think he has a wife and kids, but he's pretending to be her wife at the same time. time, and we're still, and this is the interesting thing about thinking he has a wife and kids. It's not just that it's morally dubious, but it puts a wall between him and Melanie mm-hmm. Griffith, where we know they can't end up together, where we know in some way that she, unless it's the heartbreak kid,
yeah.
where they can't end up together, where she is going to, it will be ultimately revealed that she is using him, so as we see the intentions behind what she's doing and all this, we know that there is something separating them. And so what's interesting is we then of course see that, you know, in it, that at the big turning point in the movie where the film suddenly goes from this sort of fully lit whimsical movie about a guy being pulled away to, you know, take off his shoes and go dancing in a creek and running mm-hmm. in the rain and walking out on a check and all this other stuff, the movie shifts into a crime movie where we suddenly realize the reason for all these things, the reason she needs a husband for her 10-year reunion, the reason she needs a husband to present to her mom, the reason she picked a guy who was stealing his lunch, the reason she's dressed in this crazy, ridiculous clothing is because she is the wife of a guy who is in prison, who went to prison for robbing people. And is really fucking scary. And we run into that guy. And what I love,
and it's alleged that he escaped. That he wasn't yeah. released. That he is like somehow out on.
Yeah, she doesn't know why. He's just out early. She's expecting that he's in prison. She runs into him there. He's terrifying. And literally the cinematic space in which the characters exist changes mm-hmm. in that moment. And I think it was very intentional. We happened to just see a thing because we were just fascinated by listening to Jonathan Demme talk about the movie, because he's really great to listen talk. He said it was very intentional that Tak Fujimoto, the cinematographer, had suggested a dramatic lighting change. And so what they do is it's a dance sequence at the 10-year reunion, and mm-hmm. they run towards each other and hug Jeff Daniels and Melanie Griffith. And they've been dancing, you know, to some new wave music, and it's all been fun and funky and very fully lit, and they then suddenly the lights go dark because now it's going to the slow dancing part of the mm-hmm. dance, and then Ray Liotta shows up out of darkness. And from that point forward, again, the cinematography of the movie becomes the cinematography of a thriller. So you're suddenly, and by the time we make it to the exquisite bathroom sequence at the end, we'll get to, it is like we are in a completely different film from a completely different director. It feels like the quality of the air in the room has changed. Mm-hmm. It's like the quality of what the people, actors' faces look like is different. Mm-hmm. And there's just something about, to say that, A, it works beautifully together as a film is one thing, but it's, there is a, so like even Tarantino talked about the difference between a situation that plays out type of a movie versus a story that unfolds, where if you were to jump in at a later point in the movie and see the characters at an earlier point in the movie, you would say, how the hell did those characters get to this place? And this is such an exquisite, exquisite example of that, because
very
by the time... And especially, it could be a completely different movie the second time. Because the first time, truly, and I say this to be honest, I am a sophisticated movie viewer, but maybe it was the heartbreak kid, maybe it was the fact that I could feel you pulling away from the movie next to me, but there was a point in the dance sequence, and I know the exact moment that it was, which is there's a point in the reunion sequence where walks outside and he's complaining about losing his wallet and how fucked he is if he's losing his wallet, and Jeff Daniels does a great job. It's actually a good scene. But I remember having explicitly this thought at that moment, which is, if this is the worst thing that's going to happen to this guy over the course of the movie, is he loses his wallet, I don't think I can watch the second half. Like, I don't think this movie can sustain this any longer. Mm-hmm. And I had, maybe it's because of the experience we had in the Heartbreak Kid, which starts with energy and loses all of it. I was just like, I just don't think, I literally had that thought. And talk about a filmmaker who is so fucking in tuned to what is working or not working in his movie that he pushes it to exactly that point, and it was me who lost faith before. In retrospect, given where the film was going, he was doing exactly what he should have been doing at exactly that moment. But I was losing faith, and then the next literally the next beat is the midpoint turn of the movie where Ray Liotta enters as her convict ex-husband, and the film becomes a completely different film where things significantly worse than losing his wallet end up happening to Jeff Daniels by the end of it. And he is forced, Ray Liotta steals his wife back, kicks, you know, busts his nose, you know, through a series of just scenes where Ray Liotta is increasingly fucking menacing. And eventually takes
some
her.
Scenes which parallel Blue Velvet with a scary joyride with the scary boy.
Yes. And like Blue Velvet, yeah, he's pulled away by a mysterious dark-haired woman and then goes on a weird joyride in a 50s car with a scary guy. But he's pulled into this whole world by Ray Liotta, and then who ends up leaving with Melanie Griffith, and he leaves busted nose kind of to flee, and then he follows her, follows them, and our hero, it feels suddenly by the end of it like we're watching some sort of noir film about a guy following two people in this car trying to get the blonde girl back from the gangster who's kidnapped her, observing all this stuff, buying binoculars, and again, it just transitions so seamlessly. I can almost, and I have to imagine this was the case as well, because of some of the. You can see how, you know, people would watch a movie like this and think one could just effortlessly, just kind of have your cake and eat it too. It's like, well, I'll make my quirky indie film for the first half, full of like talking heads music and bullshit and people dancing like it's some French new wave bullshit movie, and then we'll just effortlessly switch the movie into a genre picture in the back half, and that'll put asses in seats and we'll end on with a big bang. And especially post Tarantino, we saw a lot of people trying to do that. In a lot of ways, even a film like you know, in some ways, I guess, films even like, you know, Go and stuff like that almost feel like they, which are post-Tarantinian, but they kind of really kind of draft off this same kind of energy. But you know, it's this kind of thing where it's so well done in just how much the it so fully embraces what the film is in the first half that you just don't, you assume that scenes and shots and sequences like the bathroom sequence couldn't exist in this movie, and yet they pay. Not only do they exist, but they are so very, very good, and they pay off so well. But Cliff, Ray Liotta in this movie, first movie, what'd you think?
Oh, he was fantastic, fantastic. I think just listening to some interviews with Jonathan Demme, he said that he wanted someone who could really scare him.
Yes.
And that is definitely immediately achieved when Ray Liotta is on screen, and at every second that he's on screen, he is scary. Yep. It's like there's no good intentions behind his eyes for even 1 millisecond of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, very similar to the Dennis Hopper character in Blue Velvet. It's like any moment he's on screen, there's only bad intentions. Coming from that.
He just has this energy where it feels like he's just radiating violence and percolating violence. And there's that, again, it's
like
in
a behind-the-eyes crazy. It's hard to... Yeah.
It is a surreal level of whole control that Jonathan Demme is revealing here, that he will eventually, obviously he's in a direct, you know, Silence of the Lambs just a few years later. But there's a shot in the movie where we just go from the whimsical dancing to the light going down to them exiting frame, and then Ray Liotta dances and the camera drifts into this Scorsese-esque push-in on his, which is funny because he'll be in Goodfellas just a couple years later, push-in on his face, and in a moment we have just transitioned into a different genre, a different cinematic space, and by the end of it, he, in a fantastic sequence, steals her back, something that feels very 1940s. He pulls up outside of a diner, he sees a cop pull up outside the diner, he goes in, he gets the girl back because Ray Liotta can't make any moves because there's a cop there, etc. And then Ray Liotta chases him all the way back to his suburban house, and this is where we finally see the reality of his divorced life there with Melanie Griffith. And when Ray Liotta shows up menacingly in that scene and busts through the window, then Jonathan Demme talked about, and again, I couldn't help but just dig into more about how this was made because it was just such a refreshing surprise. Again, part of the reason it feels like a completely different cinematic space is that they completely changed the approach to the filmmaking, which is there's this taut action sequence, which is which involves Ray Liotta chaining Jeff Daniels to a sink, and then he goes to kick the shit out of Melanie Griffith, and Jeff Daniels has to rip the pipe out of the sink, and then he's fighting, but his hands are still cuffed, and Ray Liotta has a knife, and they're fighting with the handcuffs and the knife and the water spraying. And instead of the whole rest of the film, which felt indie and extemporaneous and felt like an actor's director, and it really was, you get the sense they made the film just by showing up on location, allowing actors to move around, interacting with non-professionals, suddenly becomes this De Palma-esque, Scorsese-esque, highly storyboarded sequences where, you know, knives are being knocked out of the hand and clattering to the ground in close-ups with water tittering on them, and Jeff Daniels,
a fight scene you really didn't know which way it was going to go,
a
like,
brutal
really
fight
thought,
scene, yeah.
I not to cut you off or anything, and not to spoiler, but like I really thought we were going to be like, oh, he's going to kill the dude, like he's just straight up going to kill the villain,
that's the thing,
and it's going to be a runoff, and then he surprisingly doesn't. And
maybe
then,
more so than any sequence in a movie I can think of in recent memory. When Ray Liotta is going after Melanie Griffith, and then Jeff Daniels uses his handcuffs and chokes Ray Liotta after he rips the thing out of the pipe, chokes him and starts choking him, I think I was digging my hands into your leg during that sequence, you know, just because I had to stop myself, just because I was like, fucking kill him! Get him! Like, I was trying to choke Ray Liotta to death in my theater seat, and I was, like, trying to help Jeff Daniels choke him out. Like, I had completely lost touch with the idea that this was a movie, and that there was going to be a predetermined end. I genuinely thought that if I contracted my muscles hard enough that we could get him to black out together, me... Because I've seen Purple Rose of Cairo. I know Jeff Daniels can walk down off the screen at any moment, so I can walk over there and help him kick the shit out of Ray. But that is how viscerally invested, and I think also seeing it in a packed theater definitely fucking helped. But again, it's just very, very rarely. It's like a director has a thumbprint, you know, and you can tell what is or isn't possible, because a director cannot just change styles on a dime, especially not deftly and in service of the story. And yet he's directing a perfect kind of whimsical indie film where there's like non-professional actors and musicians in coming in and out of the film in the first half, and he's directing one of the most brutal and horrifying kind of bathroom fight sequences that's akin to anything that Scorsese or later on Tarantino would do in its intensity. All of a sudden the angles change, you're getting this very graphic shots, and by graphic I don't mean violent, but like the direct overhead shot of the sink, you know, where his arms are tied, but we can't see his arms, and he has to bring his legs around underneath and rip out the pipe. Like, those kinds of angles did not exist in this film. It was not that type of a movie. So the whole cinematic space in which the characters exist change when the stakes change, and it's done so well. I don't know, it's just, I was kind of just really kind of blown away. And then the film, again, has taken you to such a place, and it's made you give a shit about these characters and give a shit about their romance. And even though their romance, which is fated to not work because he's married, and then we realize it can work, and then we realize the only thing stopping it from working is Ray Liotta, and he's a monster, and he's takes her literally like a monster and kidnaps her, and Jeff Daniels has to fight for her back. It allows us to return to this place where then at the end of the movie, we can go right back to the whimsical place where we began the movie, and we're outside the diner again, and he runs into Melanie Griffith, and kind of whimsical kind of world beat music that permeates the rest of the movie comes back. And it's like, I feel like I have gone on a full cinematic experience to hell and back through all of these different, through all of these different cinematic spaces that are all so exquisitely executed that I don't know. It's just, it's a lot to process, but I really fucking good.
It just occurred, a very small comparison or small note, but it just occurred to me that both movies had a musical motif throughout the whole thing. The first movie had, what's the song? Close to You.
That's right, the Carpenter song.
And then the whole second movie was literally named after Wild Things.
That is a very good point.
Sings,
that is a very good point. The first film, the Close to You song, the Carpenter song, is playing
multiple times
in different variations, ironically, etc., throughout the Heartbreak Kid. And they have a bunch of different versions of Wild Thing.
Even closing up the credits.
Yeah, closing credits. They have that one woman singing with that great shot where the pan's over, and then it's just they have this kind of like woman just singing Wild Thing against against a red wall. It just feels fucking great and so unique and so cool. And the music's very cool throughout, even if it is all that sort of hip New York bullshit throughout the whole thing. It's like, I give him a pass. It's so good that I just can't stop the thing. It's like, especially when they arrive at the dance and everything, and there's that weird fucking new wave band. I have to remind myself over and over again that this is when those things were still transgressive and cool, and the, you know, and the purview of like cool gay people and art people in New York, and not just sort of the music of like really pretentious college educated intelligentsia here and stuff.
I think it still was then, but you know, it was charming and new at the time.
It was charming and new at the time. There you go. But man, I don't know. I just it was cool to go in, especially after Heartbreak Kid left me feeling a little bit cold. It was really awesome to have that cinematic experience. I have not had a cinematic experience of being that. I don't know why. I mean, it's the kind of thing where it's we've seen Silence of the Lambs a million times. We know the level of talent that he had, but it's just I felt myself wanting more from the movie, and it gave me more at exactly that moment, and I wasn't necessarily expecting it to, and I don't know why.
I really think that it following Heartbreak Kid both hurt and helped it a lot. I think that Heartbreak Kid means...
I think it hurt it in your mind for the first half, because you're like, fuck these movies.
At one point, they like outright in the movie, they're like, oh yeah, I have a wife and kids, and Kyle turns to me and he goes, does he have kids? And I go, he has a wife and multiple kids. he is cheating on his wife and three kids.
Yeah, no, that's fun. It's also funny that that was a time where that was how the kind of alti artsy indie set expressed their deconstruction of the mainstream was just by telling whimsical narratives about men cheating on their wives, etc., etc. And as opposed to now, that guy would be the villain in any movie made by, you know, those anyone, sorts of people. Any sort, like I was watching because I was trying to kind of get some perspective a little bit on Heartbreak Kid. I was watching some professor give some tortured explanation as to why Heartbreak Kid is a feminist film, and I can see that from a certain angle, but at the same time her
with your eyes closed,
I feel like I could make a better case than she was making for that, but nevertheless, after. From a, as opposed to the cool, satirical, squirmy, intellectual exercise that was kind of flat, that was heartbreaking, very funny, but that sort of left me feeling cold at the end. Just being so taken off guard by where I'm so glad I went in cold. Like, I'm so glad I didn't know, like, I didn't listen to some asshole on a podcast spoiling everything for me about something wild before I went in and saw it. It is so fucking good. And Melanie Griffith, just again, we're coming right off of Body Double, is fantastic in the movie. I think she's kind of the you buy her as being that aggressively eccentric that she can pull that off that whole thing. She, again, another thing that is absent in movies today is they actually have sex in the movie shortly after. Remember, they sleep together when she chains him up with the handcuffs.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Oh, you know, you're so funny, because you're absolutely right. I didn't realize they actually did have sex in that scene, because there's a later scene where Ray Liotta and Jeff Daniels are like talking as she's like in the lunchroom or whatever. And that was like a big character defining moment between the two of them, where he's like, oh yeah, she must be crazy in the sack. You're totally banging her because you're her husband or whatever. And he just kind of immediately goes, there's no need for that language.
Oh, yeah.
And you can just see Ray being like, okay, wise guy, we were having fun, or whatever, whatever.
Yeah, there's, I guess part of one of the things to talk about is just talk about the amazing cast. Melanie Griffith was fantastic, but Jeff Daniels is one of those actors one of the only actors who I think could pull off a moment like that.
Yeah,
that's such a great
sure.
Jeff Daniels moment. Because again, when Ray Liotta is saying, like, I bet she could fuck, she looks like she could fuck you in half, just right in half. And he turns to her and says, well, I don't think there's any call for that kind of language. He sells that. Like, and A, it's because he's a phenomenal actor, but you believe it coming from his big corn-fed head.
Yeah.
And he just sells it in such a way, like in a kind of Clark Kent kind of way.
But it also, what's fun about it, though, is that it serves multiple purposes. Besides the fact that, you know, you see him having a little bit of gumption to stand up to Ray Liotta, but it's also the moment from Ray Liotta's perspective. It's like, oh, you did sleep with her.
Yeah.
This is more than just this is stringing along someone.
Yeah,
so that's
good
the
point.
It's like, I'm going to kill this guy after that.
That is
so,
very interesting.
Multiple things going on there.
And I got to say, the other thing that really struck me about it is, like, again, there's this kind of aspect where there's a lot of non-professional actors coming into the movie all the time, doing various bits and everything. What is it? I was listening to Jonathan Demme talking about, he has this awareness. Demme has this awareness that the audience is going to be disconnecting from, unlike the Heartbreak Kid, are going to be trying to resist empathizing with Jeff Daniels because he's cheating on his wife for the first half. So he said he very intentionally wanted to show him, and we've touched on this a little bit earlier, being decent to everyone, getting along with everybody, seeing, you know, in an explicit way, the fact that he learns every waitress's name on the name tags and everything, but that then gets reincorporated into the movie in a meaningful way. Melanie Griffith's character observes that of him, that he's a decent guy. But what's really cool is that Jonathan Demme pays that off in an almost, you know, metaphysical way in the back half of the movie. Is that the first half of the movie, where he's this whimsical guy who's nice to people and all this other kind of stuff, actually still suffuses the second half of the film, the crime movie, with meaning in the sequence when he is pursuing Melanie Griffith and he's following her. We don't question that he would go after her because he's good. You know, he's a good guy. We see that he's a good guy and he's going to rally and he's going to go after Ray Liotta. And it's why Ray Liotta and Melanie Griffith, when he later sits on down in the diner scene, say, "You are so fucking stupid. Like, you are so fucking stupid to do this." You know, we know he's going to go after her. But at the same time, and I know this is intentional because we heard Jonathan Demme talk about it, but it's beautiful, is this idea that all the warmth he's put out to people in the world over the course of the film comes back to him as this empowering force, like the guy in the convenience store who's helping him change his clothes and get out of his, points out he has a bloody shirt, and so he takes off the bloody shirt and puts on a clean shirt and helps him get some shorts and helps him get some
What's
stuff.
What's it like, Jeff? Be cool. Try to be cool.
Yeah, he's like, oh yeah, he says, "Charlie, try and be cool."
As he gets naked in the store.
That this interaction, which is, again, feels almost like a cinematic texture in the beginning of the movie. Again, that sort of new Hollywood affectation of having non-professional actors interacting with your stars. And yet, the way in which he interacts with everyone, he's singing along with all the people in the car when they pick up hitchhikers, then it's like he is not alone on his quest. On when he's actually hunting down Ray Liotta at the end, there's these people helping him out along the way, and it all and so what could be a very cold feeling film that just becomes just very isolated, and it's about him staring with binoculars with bruises on his face, you still see the same oh shucks guy on in this crime. It seems wildly incongruous, but in this cinematic space where he doesn't belong, where there's fucking Ray Liotta's there now, that's never a good sign, and fucking Melanie Griffith has a punk rock
haircut. One thing that Ray Liotta would be typecast in for the rest of his career, if Ray Liotta's on screen, something bad is going on.
You don't want to be there if Ray Liotta's around. And so, and same thing, Melanie Griffith, just coming off of Body Double, you know, it's like last time she had a weird crazy haircut and was wearing lingerie, there was a guy literally drilling holes through women with a 3-foot drill. He doesn't belong there, and so it would be very easy for Jonathan Demme to just abandon the whole cinematic space in which Jeff Daniels' character exists and just change him. Now he's tough, he has bruises on his face, he's looking out car windows, following them, but instead he allows him to still be the same oh shucks guy and still interact with people, and so his goodness sort of continues to be his power through that whole section of the movie, including right up until the end, when he takes Melanie Griffith from Ray Liotta in that diner, where it's all about coming in, sitting down, laying out his options, just to let you know there's no hard feelings. I'm going to take care of this check and all this. He's very polite about
everything.
Which
is like a nod to earlier what she did to him.
Yeah, and she ends up keeping him trapped there because he can't run out on the check. It's all great. It's all very, very good stuff. But there's this interesting, I don't know, it's just this, in the same way that the first film we were talking about, Heartbreak Kid, seems to be kind of, and again, it's a very, 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 very different movie. It's just a kind of satirical, funny movie. The way Heartbreak Kid seems to be agnostic about how we are feeling about the characters as real people, about their morality, about their heart, about their soul, about their emotions, about who they are, and keeping, and then once committing to those ideas, it's like, in the same way, the Heartbreak Kid doesn't seem to be at all concerned with that. In fact, it's sort of, I kind of ironically thumbing its nose at that whole notion. You know, Something Wild manages to be punk rock and anarchic and cool and all of these things, while at the same time revealing to you that it is very aware of all of these things. It's very aware of the character's heart and their soul and the morality of the film and where energies are being cultivated and where they need to be paid off and where they need to be mediated and all that. So anyway,
I think a really great example of that, and again, like the actual end of the movie, is there's like a scene earlier on where like Ray Liotta is like talking to Jeff Daniels' character, saying like, "Do you think like you're gonna end up with her? Like she's not gonna end up driving a station wagon for the rest of her life. Like this is like she's crazy. You're gonna be crazy if you're gonna be with her." And then all at the very end of the movie, he does end up finding her through a bunch of plot stuff, and she is driving a very nice station wagon.
Yeah, she's driving an old station wagon.
Do you
want to
come for a drive?
Yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm. I love that. I love all of that. And the film, it just playing all those symbols off of each other. His provincial life, which is so square in the beginning of the movie. He literally drives a square car, a station wagon, you know, and that she's liberating him from his life by running away with him. In her Mustang. And then we ultimately realize that he actually has a very sad and shattered life, and how they ultimately find catharsis is by coming back together as an actual couple in a station wagon.
Yeah.
She's literally wearing a white hat like she's a movie star from a previous
era.
Yeah,
like Audrey Hepburn.
Exactly, exactly.
Oh, Audrey, haha.
Well, it's like, and she's the daughter of Tippi Hedren, who is the actress from The Birds and many Hitchcock movies and stuff like that. Which,
there we go.
By the way, and which also we should talk about in a minute, that she was also grew up around lions, literal lions.
Oh, wow.
No, her father was a director. To tell you the story of the movie Roar real quick, Melanie Griffith grew up. She was the daughter of Tippi Hedren. I forget her father's name. I was a director. They decided to become really involved in big cat
conservation,
to the extent that they lived on initially in LA and then later on moved to Africa, I think. But
Like big
20
move.
Pet lions, which
became
like 70 pet lions.
As they do.
So they're living with all these fucking full-size lions, and there's like magazine spreads of how they're living like lions in the house on kitchen tables, laying by the pool with like a young teenage Melanie Griffith, who's their daughter, you know, with all these fucking lions around her all the time. Like she's in a hot tub with a fucking tiger, full-size tiger. So she grows up like this. So in order to help, you know, spread awareness of their lion efforts and whatever, they make a movie called Roar about kind of not a documentary, but a narrative film about these people who live in perfect harmony with their lions, and then evil poachers try and get them. And there's a very thin on plot. It's basically people live amongst lions. And famously, the production was insane.
Oh, I can imagine.
As you can imagine, people trying to do stunts and stuff around lions, and lions being lions, it was full of just people being maimed and bitten and all sorts of other stuff.
I think Melanie Griffith was scratched or injured in the face by a lion during.
So at some point she got fucked up by a lion. So if you ever wonder, Melanie Griffith made her bones in Hollywood by actually literally fighting her ways out of the jaws of a lion.
Blood, sweat, and tears.
And famously, and again, this is not necessarily the most pleasant thing in the world, but one of our warm-up episodes for this podcast we did on Speed, which was directed by the great Jan de Bont, who before he was a director was a cinematographer. And one of the early things he shot as a young cinematographer was Roar. And he was scalped by one of the lions who clawed his head during the movie, and they had to put his head back on, or flap that stuff down and stitch him back up.
Hey, just walk it off.
So stable anyway, Roar, really crazy movie, and I say that it's just one of those movies that what is most surreal about Roar is the fact that despite the fact that everyone's surrounded by lions and there's lions everywhere, and clearly there's scenes that make you just fucking tense up because like a guy's wrestling with a lion and then it looks like something's going wrong, or like a guy's tackled by a lion that clearly like knocked the wind out of him or whatever the fuck. While all of this is happening, the film has this like very light, whimsical Disney movie tone to it with like light music and fun, like a fam. Oh, you silly lion. And the lion's like just continues to fucking drive this guy into the ground. But I was like, you're just being such a big goofball. And this fucking lion's on top of him. And anyway, it definitely will make your butthole clench. Roar. Butthole clenching movie.
Yeah, Tiger King who?
So exactly. So Melanie Griffith, if you're wondering how that crazy girl from Body Double and from Something Wild ended up, how she is, lions. Lots of lions.
Scalping is no joke. Yeah. I'm still stuck on that. Yeah. That is so but crazy.
But we're circling back. So she's Tippi Hedren's daughter. So she shows up literally looking like a 40s movie star. Mm-hmm, she gets in. They get into their station wagon to
nice
go off.
Their nice wooden station wagon.
Yeah, but he has left his square job, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, side note. The entire weekend that he's been doing all of his debauchery, it is because on Monday he starts his new promotion as vice president of the business job.
Yes, vice president of the business corporation.
After his debauchery weekend, he has lost the girl, supposedly, and then he quits his job almost immediately, or at least put his resignation in,
that's the thing, is that, so, what is it, I forget, Melanie Griffith shows up at the end, they're in their station wagon, all that other good stuff, I forget exactly where I was going with all that, but yes, it pays off in a way that feels... it feels like that's the right ending for the movie. It feels like everything in the movie is building toward that ending. It feels like, I don't know, it left in the same way that The Heartbreak Kid, we kind of felt we went out on a low. I went out on a real fucking high at the end of Something Wild. And I don't know, I think that just probably, if anything, and this is maybe me reading too much into it, but it, I think on some level, derives from where these two different films came from. You know, you have The Heartbreak Kid, which is coming very much out of a, you know, sort of benighted class of comedians in New York making sort of ironic and intellectual material for each other, versus Jonathan Demme, who came out, again, different eras as well, but Jonathan Demme came out of Roger Corman's New World Pictures. He came out of a space of loving movies, but also a space of Roger Corman. Jonathan Demme, for all of his success, was probably been the most effusive in his praise of Roger Corman. He seemed to, on an intellectual level, understand more so than any other filmmaker what made Roger Corman magical and significant. The idea that Roger Corman didn't want to participate in the having a job at the studio system, taking their notes thing. Jonathan Demme had that experience on Swing Shift, which apparently was a big debacle. And so Jonathan Demme seemed to get that by Roger Corman taking total control of the production process and kind of treating the production as part of the art form, that's actually a Joe Bob Briggs quote about Roger Corman, that he could have a truly, truly unique career. And no one, Jonathan Demme certainly has had this incredible career where he directed narrative films and documentaries and concert films. He directed a Justin Timberlake concert film.
Woo!
J. Timms. He had this incredible career that influenced clearly the careers of Paul Thomas Anderson and Richard Linklater, who all sort of seemed to model their career off of Jonathan Demme's career and do all of that same kind of bullshit. But he seemed to come out of New World Pictures with an actual understanding of, like, what is a crime film supposed to fucking do? What is a romance film supposed to fucking do? How does a movie actually fucking work? And when you hear him talk about Something Wild, you hear him talk about, how am I going to make people really, how am I going to make this movie work? How am I going to make people invest in this movie? And he quotes Roger Corman's rules about filmmaking. Famously, Roger Corman would sit people down and give them like a 90-minute spiel about how to make a movie. But he quotes them like scripture. The idea that the villain has to be scary comes from Roger Corman. The idea that every part, even the incidental parts like the Clerks, have to be very well considered and very well thought out because that person owns the movie. He is really thinking about a film as something that needs to work in that Roger Corman way.
Deliver the goods.
Deliver the goods. That's a much better way of saying it. As opposed to the sort of chin-scratching, intellectual, satirical, but definitely more cerebral exercise that was The Heartbreak Kid, the adaptation of some magazine story into a script and into a satirical film, which doesn't hold together energetically as a movie. And yet you see, it's so small, relatively speaking. It's just mostly two people on screen the whole movie. Even the big action set piece sequence that we're like going gaga over, takes place in a fucking bathroom. So it's like, again, the scale of the movie is incredibly, mm-hmm. incredibly small.
They had to pay to replace that carpet, Kyle.
No
That's
doubt.
A high
no doubt.
Budgetary
no doubt.
Item.
I bet they built that whole fucking bathroom. but again, it's such a small movie, and yet it brings me on. It brings me on the full arc of a film, like going to see a big, like a fucking Basic Instinct or the mm-hmm. Verhoeven-esque thriller, which ends where, or fucking Fatal Attraction, killing Glenn Close. Like, it takes me all the way to that place by the end of the movie, and yet it is such this small. And it really fucking works, man. It's
sure
really good.
Fired out.
And I'm remembering the movie and whatnot. I think it also has a lot of fun that it doesn't necessarily stick to one play. Like you're saying, like halfway through the movie changes genre. Like I think it even plays around with the relationship between the two main characters being such that in the reunion scene and you meet the character, the guy that's actually from his corporation or whatnot, yeah. and she just, again, with her crazy wildness, basically just says, oh yeah, we're expecting a baby. All of his crazy is definitely not what he wants his coworker to be hearing. He actually kind of wants us to be out the door.
Yeah,
and then they kind of has a very serious, his first serious moment with her being like, what was that? Like, he's real. This is real. Like, you need to stop. And, you know, it kind of has that moment of there mm-hmm. back and forth, much like the wallet scene a little bit later, shortly thereafter or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. No, and that's the thing, is that that's the moment where he asserts that he values the order of his life more so than the whimsical bullshit, you know, that she's pulling him away to. Like, this is fine, but you're fucking with my actual life if this and that. And then Ray Liotta shows up one scene later to thoroughly fuck with his life. And then he chooses ultimately, despite what he says in that scene, mm-hmm. when he's given the opportunity to run home and return to his life with his tail between his legs, he doesn't even for a second, and continues to pursue Melanie Griffith, continues to pursue them down the road, et cetera, et cetera. And it's
and
just
we're invested emotionally in his journey to do that, intensely so, unlike his pursuit of in the Heartbreak Kid, you know, for more and more comparisons, of another blonde in that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I gotta say, it is interesting, because there is that idea that once Melanie Griffith finds out that he is not married, mm-hmm. she's very upset at him, and it's an interesting scene, because you realize that it reveals so much about her character, that she needed him to be cheating on his wife so that they were both bad people using each other. She needed him to be cheating on his wife so that even it's okay if she falls for him, in love with him a little bit, because he always was going to have to go back to his wife and it doesn't matter. So scenes like when they're sitting there and there's the golf course in the background and she says, yeah, I just like how you, and it's clearly them falling in love with each other. She's just, I love how you, you know, learn all the people's names from their name tag. That's just such a fun thing that you do. He says, well, how else are you going to let people know that, you know, they're appreciated? Whatever the fucking thing he's saying. Mm-hmm. They're falling in love, but she still has this safeguard up of, he will go back to his wife eventually. This will end. I'm not using blah, 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 blah.
And he even kind of acknowledges, like, if I had told you it wasn't true, then you would have left. Because I would have.
Exactly, exactly. And so finally, once that is removed, she flees, and then she has to make the decision to come back to him ultimately. Mm-hmm. At the end of the movie, and she fucking better. I mean, he killed Ray Liotta, for Christ's sake.
Did he kill
him?
I'm trying.
Yeah, no, presumably he's dead.
No,
he was
right,
rolled
right,
out
right,
in a body
right.
bag at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though I did find it odd, though. I find not odd, wonderful cinematically about, you know, what they show, what they don't show in that final fight scene. We never see Ray Liotta even collapse or fall down. The last we see of him is his feet squishing on the wet carpet as he exits the bathroom into the hallway and just walks hauntingly away down into this dark carpet. And then we cut away, and then we presume that he collapses and dies at some point.
Yeah. Yep.
And the cops are here, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, no, very, very cool moment. That whole bathroom sequence is just phenomenal. And I just remember being in the midst of it. And I very rarely am I in the movies anymore. And I'm just like, I can't believe we're here. I'm having such a good time. I'm literally like putting bruises in Taylor's legs because I'm trying to choke Ray Liotta out and stuff. So I don't know. I guess that we have certainly talked these things probably to death, I'd say.
Go see Something Wild. Yes. Like, go stream it. Go find it in theater. But like, go check it out. It's a great, great movie.
Yeah, you know, we absolutely. It was really cool getting to see that on 35 with a bunch of fucking people. But see it any way you can, because it's a really, really good movie. And yeah, I am amazed it took me this long to see it. And I'm just glad we're coming on. We have something so that we like so much to talk about on the podcast.
Yeah.
So anyway. But yeah, I guess that's it. So there's really only one thing left to do, or a couple things left to do, which is Cliff, who was the most jacked? of all of the people in both feeling. Something
well,
Wild.
Despite the fact that there's some buff-looking football players in Whatchamacallit
and Heartbreak Kid.
But you know, obviously we'll go to Ray Liotta, who we've never seen Ray Liotta this jacked before. Yeah. Clearly in the rest of his movie career, he slowly slims down, but he's in maximum, you know, tight muscle, tight
black. I was about to say that, like, I'm not sure if he's jacked or if he just has the tightest black t-shirt on.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think that just like head size, in absence of real jackness, the tightness of a black t-shirt can win you the award. Yeah. And I think he fills out his t-shirt just fine. So it is a very tight black t-shirt, though.
And we thank him for it.
So the Full Metal Jacket Award goes to Ray Liotta then, Cliff.
That, absolutely. All right. There you go.
Excellent. All right. Well, then, well, we can only speculate as to the meanings of these films because we are mere mortals. But so that we can give you, our viewers at home, lessons, moral and spiritual, that you can take from The Heartbreak Kid and Something Wild, we must consult the spirits. And so we have done a tarot draw to decipher what it is that the world of spirits has to tell us and what lessons we can give you that you can take with you into the following week from Heartbreak Kid and Something Wild. So I'm very curious as to what this is, but Taylor, draw the card. Do it. Flip it over. It is. Right set up. It's the Eight of Swords. This is a perfect card, actually, for these movies. This is very not a hard connection to make at all. So the Eight of Swords, as you see right there, is the features a gal who is tied up, just like Jeff Daniels in the movie, tied up, wearing a blindfold, and she is surrounded by swords stuck into the sand all around her. There's water at her feet, and there's an island in the background. And this is a lot about this is a card about self-imprisonment. The idea that she is blindfolded, she is tied up, and she is surrounded by swords, and believes that she is imprisoned on the card, but if she removed the blindfold, she could see that she can actually walk quite freely away from the swords at any moment. And what a movie like Something Wild is about someone casting off that kind of social blindfold, that feeling of imprisonment, that liberation. Both films, in fact, are about someone who feels imprisoned. Charles Grodin, imprisoned by marriage at the beginning of Heartbreak Kid, and Jeff Daniels feels that he is imprisoned by
his
job.
Life.
Yeah, exactly. His job that he can't fuck with and he can't take the afternoon off from lunch with. They feel imprisoned, but just like the blindfold in here, they are blinded and they realize that that is a self-imprisonment and they must, if they remove their blindfold, they can walk free. I would say that the Heartbreak Kid would represent the eight of swords inverted. That is to say, it would represent someone who would either keep the blindfold on or remove the blindfold only to find themselves continued to be returning to a new blind imprisonment, like we see Charles Grodin at the end of the film. That is to say, be careful, audience at home, that if you are fucking with your life and moving to Los Angeles or deciding that you just need to dye your hair pink or do something, that you're not throwing off the wrong chains and blinding yourself and ending up in some new form of imprisonment. Be Jeff Daniels. Be the Eight of Swords. Straight up. The Eight of Swords being that he casts off the blindfold, he uses the swords that are next to him on the beach to cut off his binds, and then, just like the girl, you see that island behind her, a new world of possibilities is available to her. He casts all that off, and he swims to that new island, quitting his vice president's job. So make sure you're casting off the right chains, everybody, and that you're not walking into a new prison. Make sure that you're getting a station wagon with a really hot, still in her 20s, Melanie Griffith, who totally banged you hard early on in the movie with handcuffs and stuff. So that would be my recommendation spiritually to the audience. Anyone else have any ideas based upon that?
No, just really, really bad movie as Heartbreak Kid and really good movie. Something. No, joking is not bad. They're both great movies. Yeah. They're both movies worthwhile seeing for their own reasons
and
making your own opinions. But yeah, Something Wild is really great.
Yeah, no, I really, really, I both had a mixed experience with Heartbreak Kid and a transcendently good experience with Something Wild, which feels like it's one of my new favorite movies. So anyway. I guess that's it, everybody. I guess we can wrap up. So I suppose for the crowded theater, I am Kyle.
I am Taylor.
I am Cliff.
And we will see you guys at the movies and in a crowded theater. Later, y'all.
Bamo.
Bye.
Woo!